Good morning, and thanks for listening to Between the Covers on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm guest host Sarika Mehta, and today we're featuring an interview with author Jean Kwok, whose debut novel, Girl in Translation, earned high acclaim. The book features the story of a Chinese girl, Kimberly, who immigrated with her mother from Hong Kong to Brooklyn. Their story parallels Jean Kwok's own life with tales of working in a sweatshop, struggling to negotiate between two vastly different worlds, and striving for success in order to survive. Girl in Translation was published back in 2010, and Jean Kwok has appeared on KBOO previously. This time, she made a special visit back to Portland as the featured author of the 2013 PCC Reads Initiative. I met up with her back in April at the Portland Community College Cascades campus. Well, Jean Kwok, welcome back to KBOO, and thank you so much for chatting with me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
First, this book I know is based on real life experiences that you had. So what inspired you to write this book, or how did you decide when you were going to do it?
I think that, in many ways, the decision to write a book creeps up on you. And I always knew that I had an unusual background because we moved from Hong Kong to the U.S. when I was five, and then we started living in this run-down, unheated, roach-infested apartment. And, you know, at the same time, we started working in a sweatshop in Chinatown in a clothing factory. And even though I was only 5 years old, I did as well. So I always knew that that was material I wanted to write about. And I think that at the heart of that material was my mother, because no matter how hard I had it as a child, she had it even harder. You know, I remember that apartment was icy cold in the winter because there was no heating system. And she would turn on the oven and open it, and that was our only source of heat in the whole apartment. And then we always had work that she brought home from the factory. And every night, you know, when I went to sleep, I remember her sitting there by that open oven, working and falling asleep and working and with her head drooping until deep into the night, because our work was never done. And I think that image and that concept of my mother always drove me to want to be a writer. And I made the decision when I was in college at Harvard. And it was a hard decision to make because I had to choose a lack of financial stability to make that decision. But it was something I actually always had to do. And I'm very glad I've done it.
Absolutely. In your book and obviously in your real life, you've had a pretty intense childhood experience with working in a sweatshop, living in a home that was barely livable, you know, by any human standard. And a lot of people, I don't think that they know that this life exists for many, many immigrant families, especially in New York and in that time. When you were writing this, how did you cope with dealing with the content of the book in something you were so heavily invested?
I think that I basically dealt with it by lying to myself, because I was like, well, you know, I'll write this as a work of fiction. And since I write it as a work of fiction, nobody's ever going to know that it happened to me. So that was what I told myself. And it turned out to be completely untrue, because, of course, the moment that the book came into the world, the very first question on everyone's mind was exactly what you just said, which is, can this happen in America? Do people live like that? Is that possible? And I realized at that point that it was an important part of the message of my book to stand up and say, actually, yes, they do. And yes, we did. We lived exactly like that. So, of course, the book is a work of fiction, but the apartment in the book, the factory, those descriptions are all completely true. And it was hard to write about them, but it was necessary as well. And I think that's why I did it.
I was curious, since your book was published in 2010 till now, especially here at the PCC campus for this big PCC Reads initiative, how have people responded to your experiences and your writing?
Oh, in the most wonderful way. So I've been so lucky, because so many people have written me or come up to me to say, I understand this book because I can identify with it. And not just people who are immigrants, but people who have experienced that feeling of being an outsider or of having overcome difficulties. And I think that's you know, why the book speaks to people. And it's the best thing in the world when I hear it, because it makes me feel like, well, that was really why I wanted to write that book. And I'm so thrilled that it touched somebody who was maybe in a position similar to that of mine, or maybe the daughter of someone like that, or, you know, the friend, and not just Chinese immigrants, but also, you know, Italian, German, all types. And also even people like, you know, someone who's deaf came up to me and said, oh, it captures so well that feeling of being on the other side.
And that's a good segue into my next question, that you were experiencing basically having a double life, being a child of an immigrant and having to hide what you're experiencing at school from your mother, and similarly hiding what you experience at home and in the factory from your school life, especially at the prep school stage. Talk about that experience that entire population you were just describing, these people will deal with.
I think that growing up with a foot in different worlds is something that a lot of people can identify with. And it is, it's difficult. You know, when I was growing up, I never told any of my friends about my real life, you know, about where we came from or how poor we were, because, you know, I wanted to leave it behind us. And I had told a friend or two when I was much younger, and they didn't believe me. You know, they'd asked their parents, and then the parents would come back and say, no. No one lives like that in America. Kids don't work in factories in America. And so I think that, you know, that was difficult. And then when my book came out, I know someone said to me, you know, he said, thank goodness you wrote this, because I have tried to tell my wife what my life was like when I worked in a factory, but she couldn't really understand it until she read the book, what that was like from moment to moment. And yes, your two lives become very separate because you don't know how to bridge that gap. You know, you don't know how to tell people, well, that's where I came from, because it seems so different from what everyone else goes through. And I guess I've realized for myself in the process of having this book be published and be, you know, so well received, that actually so many people have secret lives like that. And it's a wonderful thing when we can begin to have a dialogue about it.
There are two things that I noticed in the book. Speaking of language, the way, from Kimberly's perspective, how she would hear what people are saying and it was misunderstood, and similarly using the Cantonese idioms as they are translated into English. So talk about how you played with language in the book.
Yeah, that was something really important to me, the use of language in the book, because what I hoped when I wrote the book was that I hoped to have the reader undergo the experience of being an immigrant. I didn't want them to hear about it. I wanted them to really feel what it's like to be on the other side of that language barrier. And and that's partly also the reason that I wrote the book as fiction, so that I could play with those things. And I thought, you know, as somebody who has grown up bilingual, I know that I don't really translate from one language to another. It's really that information comes in and I send it out in whichever language is appropriate. So I thought, well, that's actually how the book has to be written. When Kimberly hears Chinese, which is her language at the beginning, she hears it fluently, and that makes us and the readers fluent in Chinese as well. So when they use Cantonese idioms like, oh, it's like picking up a dead chicken, that means, actually, that's a great thing, because it means there's a chicken dinner lying for you free at your feet. You know, that the non-Chinese reader can experience that, but more importantly, that when Kimberly is learning English and she hears somebody say something, it sounds to her like blah, 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 word I understand, blah, 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 blah. So because of that, Kimberly hears English, and then parts of that are gibberish and parts of that are words she can understand. And that allows us as the reader to know what it's like to need to respond, to need to react, and yet not be able to because we did not understand what was being said to us.
Yeah, that is a really important point that, well, hopefully a lot of educators and students took away from this book. Have you gotten any responses from educators?
Oh, so many. Yeah, so many. Because the book has been chosen for many common reads in a lot of colleges and universities and has also been adopted in many high schools. In fact, Primary Source has created an entire teacher's toolkit around the book with homework and exercises and video and history. There's a link to it on my website. And, you know, that's incredibly important to me because I love the fact that educators are using the book to reach students who might not, you know, be accessed otherwise. And I've heard also teachers say to me, I think I'm a better teacher having read the book because I understand more the limitations that a child may be facing but is afraid to tell me.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm guest host Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to an interview with award-winning author Jean Kwok. She's the author of Girl in Translation, and this book, while a work of fiction, illustrates the secret double life of Jean Kwok's childhood in Brooklyn.
And there's one other, well, there were two other points about how a child might view the world, such as counting the material cost of things in the number of skirts. And another incident where Kimberly has to take current events quizzes, which is a perfectly valid and good educational tool, but the teacher just assumed that everybody has access to the New York Times. Talk about that experience.
Well, I think that's such an astute question because it's one of the traumas of my youth, was that we had those current events quizzes. And I was good at school. You know, I was lucky to have a gift for school like Kimberly, and that was my way out of that life. But there were things that I could not compensate for. And one of them was the daily current events quiz, because exactly like her, I had no access to an English newspaper. I was at the factory until late in the night. I couldn't listen to the radio, couldn't watch TV. The thing is, I should have told my teacher, but I didn't. And I think that the child I was at that age just did not have it within her capabilities to open her mouth and tell her teacher the truth of her situation, and I didn't. But it didn't occur to the teacher that it was impossible, you know, for somebody in her class to do that. And so I failed them. I just failed them every single day. And it, you know, I mean, when I was younger, exercises like, you know, make a collage with old magazines in your house. You know, we had no magazines. I mean, I didn't have glue. I didn't have markers. I didn't have all of that stuff. But I wasn't going to tell anyone because, you know, I was embarrassed about it. And I think that's a difficulty that a lot of working class people have.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of that, the same double life question with respect for authority, whether it was teachers or your mother or Kimberly's mother or Aunt Paula, and how to negotiate the world between how we stand up for ourselves and how we respect elders and then protect ourselves at the same time.
It is really difficult. And I think that balance is kind of at the heart of being in a diverse society like the one that we live in, that, you know, I think from the parents' point of view, it's really difficult to let the children go because they've already let them go so much. You know, they've already gone so far in terms of how they feel, but it's never as far as the child wants. You know, the child always wants more freedom, more ability to make their own choices, all of those things. And I mean, I think a part of the reason I wrote the book was that I also hoped to tell Kimberly's mother's story, to let people know that this is what a first generation immigrant goes through. And these are the sacrifices that she has made for you. And that she, you know, I think immigrants sacrifice everything, their education, their degrees, their wealth, their friends, their family, for their children and their future. And that is something that we as the children need to value. But on the other hand, we also have the right to live our own lives. And I think that that is essential, and to make our own decisions. I think that at the basis of what we choose needs to be love, so that we love and respect each other and love and respect the other generation. But in the end, I do believe your life is your own, and it is your right to live your life as you see fit. And sometimes that means making decisions that someone you love won't agree with. And I think in my own life, I've had to do that as well. And I try to make sure I'm making the right decision, a good decision, not a stupid decision. I try to avoid those. But, you know, if I'm doing the best I can, that's really all I can do.
Yeah, it's a struggle for all of us who are children of immigrants. I will definitely attest to that. Switching gears a little bit, you actually live in Holland. So you've made a very long trek to Portland, and we greatly appreciate it. First, what brought you there as your second immigration?
Right, I know. It's like as if one immigrant experience was not enough, I have to have a second one. And basically what happened was I met a Dutch guy. We fell in love, and just practically, I was a writer and a teacher, so it was just easier for me to go to Holland than for him to come to the U.S. And, you know, you make these decisions thinking, oh, well, we'll see. But before you know it, you've built up a whole life there. So now we're married and we have two kids. And yes, I live in Holland. I grew up in New York, but I live in Holland. So I did go through the immigration experience twice. And I will say that it was really, it's always difficult. I mean, it's always difficult to be an immigrant. What I've learned from being an immigrant is that learning the language is essential. And that was the very first thing I did when I moved to Holland, was that I made sure I learned Dutch as well and as quickly as I could. But I will say that the first time moving from a non-Western language and culture to a Western one was huge. And the second move from the U.S. to Holland was also difficult and filled with misadventures, but it was much easier. It was just much easier. I had a diploma from Harvard and from Columbia in my suitcase when I moved, and that made all the difference. But yeah, it is, you know, I mean, at this point, I feel comfortable in all of the different societies I navigate. But it's taken a lot of time, and I've certainly done a lot of things wrong or been shocked that things are done differently here or there. I think the thing I've realized is that even though it is very hard when you have a diverse background, because you always have to choose in every situation what you're going to do, that's a great gift as well, because then you know there is a choice. And that allows you to very consciously choose your own path.
Wonderful. I just cannot fathom how you had a life working in sweatshops and having to protect your mother from other issues and living the life you had in that apartment, and then going to a prep school, and then going to Harvard. And talk about that transition.
I think when you come from difficult circumstances, what you learn is that if you don't do something to change your life won't change. It's that simple. It's not, maybe in a way I was lucky. You know, it wasn't like I had yuppie parents who were like, oh, go practice your piano lessons, you know. And I could rebel against that or something. I did not have that. I didn't have piano lessons. I didn't have any lessons. And it was very clear to me that if I just kind of coasted in my life, I would work in the factory my entire life. And I would live in an apartment like the one we lived in my entire life. And the only way that I was going to escape that was by myself and with my own efforts. So that made my life very clear. And it was difficult because I'd get picked up after school by my father, and I'd work at the factory until like 10 at night, and we wouldn't get home till 11. You know, I was 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old. I mean, I was little and I was tired, and I had homework, I had tests, I had projects, I had all these things I had to do. Did everything on the subway or at the factory during breaks. But I knew from very young that school was going to be my way out, because that was where I had an ability. That was where I could do it. And it was clear to me that I was the only one who was going to be able to make my life different.
And What about relating to your peers and your teachers in those settings?
It was very hard because nobody knew what I had at home. You know, nobody knew what my life was really like. So I had to lie to kind of get around it. Or I would do weird things like, you know, we would have to hand in a diorama and mine would be like completely pathetic when I brought it in because there was no glue, there were no markers, there was none of that stuff. So, you know, it's this kind of constant conversation to hide my situation. It was difficult. But on the other hand, you know, I loved my friends and I loved my teachers. And, you know, they kind of showed me another world and another way of being and showed me books, I mean, knowledge. I learned so many things, and that kind of was a doorway that I wanted to step through. And that gave me the motivation to do what I needed to do and to work as hard as I needed to work and to sleep as little as I needed to sleep to get everything done so that I could leave that life.
One, I mean, I guess kind of political question. With your life and the background that you had, and then we have this other issue that's in the Supreme Court right now, which is about affirmative action. And Asian Americans are pitted on both sides of this issue for a lot of stereotypical reasons. Do you have any opinions about this?
I think that, Asian Americans have been successful in general, and that's something that is, you know, fantastic. And I think that, you know, you go to a school, maybe a top school, and you see a lot of Asians there. And, you know, people have this idea that, oh, gosh, they all have it easy. They're all out. They're all this. But it's really not true. I mean, and I know from having come from a working class background, having worked in a factory and knowing working class Chinatown, that for every single successful Asian that we see, there are 100 that are left behind. And at the factory, for example, you can start working there as a child. I did, and I was not at all the only child there. You work there through your teens until you are a young person, and that's your, you know, the peak of your speed. And then as you start to slow down, you can keep working there until you're 80. And then you work there basically until you die. And there are so many people who stay in that cycle. And I think I was really lucky because my ability was in school. But, you know, I mean, at home, I was actually a disaster. And I was this terrible Chinese daughter because I'm really clumsy and I burn food and a lot of other stuff. And I was argumentative and stubborn. And so at home, I was like this disaster. But sometimes I think that if my skills had been inverted, you know, if I had been good at cooking and cleaning and bad at school, I would probably be like working in a restaurant somewhere. You know, I would be a dishwasher or a waitress or something like that. So I do think that, you know, it is important to provide support for people in need and, you know, regardless of color.
Well, thank you so much, Jean Kwok, for chatting with me on KBOO.
Thank you, and I've really so enjoyed being here.
That was award-winning author Jean Kwok, the featured author for this year's PCC Reads Initiative. Her debut novel, Girl in Translation, became a New York Times bestseller, among many other accolades. This story is a work of fiction about a girl whose immigrant life became a secret double life. You can keep up with Jean Kwok at her website, jeankwok.com, or find her on Facebook at Jean Kwok Author. This has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sari Gametta. Thanks for listening.